Bears Rock Crane, a Microsoft Office 365 MVP who knows practically everything there is about Office 365. He does stand-up events talking about Office 365. He writes about Office 365 on his blog site, and he does in-person training sessions and training videos about Office 365. There's also me, Mark Keane. I'm the voiceover guy and producer of this podcast. I'm also a Microsoft Azure technical specialist, PowerShell extraordinaire, and IT consultant helping people move to the Microsoft cloud and consume it by helping them to make sense of it. This is the Need to Know podcast with Robert Crane and Mark Keane.
Contact us by email.
Feedback@needtoknow.cloud. It's your destination for anything Microsoft Cloud, including Azure and Office 365.
So we're back for another Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and on the other side of the microphone, joining me once again is Mark Keane. Mark, how's it going?
Good, thank you. And how are you?
Not too bad. What's happening in your world at the moment?
Right now, I'm standing on the other side, or sitting on the other side of the mic, recording this podcast with you.
It's a pretty lame excuse, Mark. Surely there's more to do than there is recording podcasts in life.
You don't want to hear about my massively busy life, do you? It's huge.
Well,
enough hours in the day.
Well, exactly. Well, that's something I can certainly help you with. I'm a productivity expert, so I can give you some pointers
on that.
Can you talk to
God and ask for another hour in the day, please, officially, for everybody?
Yeah, sure. Yourself? Not a problem. Just get on an aeroplane. You get another hour once you cross the international date line. There, done.
I'll just keep flying in reverse across the date line. That'll do it.
Exactly. So again, problem solved. Next.
Except for the lineups at airport security and stuff, I'll just take those out of the equation altogether.
Yeah, I suppose so. You'll want everything. If I fix one problem and you raise another one, you're a typical customer.
So next week you are. Hang on about. Let's talk about last week. You were jet-setting around the world or jet-setting around the country. You're in Perth.
Yep. So I was at Perth on the final leg of a roadshow for one of the vendors talking about Skype for Business, SharePoint, and some backup stuff you can do in Office 365, getting the message across to partners, especially around the opportunity that's coming with the PSTN calling for Skype for Business here in Australia. So, again, finish that off. And then next week I head off to the Australian Partner Conference that's up in the Gold Coast. That's basically 4 days of meeting with Microsoft and with partners and hearing the direction that Microsoft's taking. A great networking event, not so technical, but again, always good to network with people and also see the direction that Microsoft's taking.
You must love flying.
Not particularly. If I had the opportunity, I'd much prefer to drive, but it's such a long way to drive and you do get much tired when you fly, whether when you don't fly. So, again, I think it's a better option. You get there quicker, that's for sure. But, it's something you have to get used to. And, again, given the distances that are required to get around the Australian continent, it's something that is a necessary evil. But, again, you take it in your stride. You take some podcasts along with you. You take your Kindle, a couple of magazines, watch a few movies, and before you know it, it's all over. And you either at your destination or you're back home.
And what about the armrest story that you were telling me before about the good old armrest on the plane?
Yeah, so armrest tends to be a bit of an arm wrestle with a lot of people. How people stake out their claim to the armrest is always interests me. I generally try and either take the front or the back of the armrest and at least give 50% to my neighbour. But I did have a situation once where I got on a plane and took my normal armrest position, and the person next to me decided that I must have been too hot for them, so they put a magazine between my arm and their arm. So that I wasn't touching them. So, again, obviously I must have looked infected or sick or something. But, again, so the easiest thing for me to do was to remove my arm from the armrest and give them full occupancy for the duration of the flight, which wasn't too long. So, yeah, that was a bit of an interesting turn of events when it comes to sharing with the neighbour.
I had a quick one too. I jumped on the plane and sitting at the front row, because I'm massively tall. I've got huge legs. I can't fit in economy. So I always sit in the front row always. I pay the extra money. And I got down. I got on the plane. I was the first one on. I was all prepared, sat down, quite happy, had my headphones on, had my bag up the top the compartment there at the top. All of a sudden, this other guy gets on and he puts his bag up the top next to mine and he's shoving it in there like shove, shove, shove. And I'm thinking, hang on, my bag is going to get squashed here. here. So I get out of my bloody seat. He interrupts me. I said, excuse me, mate, my bag's there. It's going to get squashed. And literally there was no room in there. He was pushing it in there. There was literally no room. I said, listen, mate, there's no room here at all. And he basically, rather than taking his bag out and putting it somewhere else, he took my bag out instead, the height of him. I said, mate, I was here first. Anyway, so the aircraft hostess butted in the middle of it and said, look, here, I can put it at the front for you. So lucky for me, my bag was up the front, nicely looked after.
Yeah, it's always a bit of a cage match these days when it comes to carry-on. It's very interesting what people are allowed to bring on planes, and I agree with you. I've had the situation where my bag has been relocated without my permission, and it's always a bit of a worry. But eventually, I haven't had anything lost or stolen, but it is a bit disrespectful. I agree with you.
So let's get on to news just quickly, because we have got quite a large guest coming on very, very shortly. So if you want to kick off with a bit of good old Office 365 news on your side, what have you got?
A couple of things, two quick things around SharePoint. So the first thing is we're beginning to see the rollout of the new SharePoint experience for lists. So again, we've seen that for document libraries where it gets a makeover, responsive design, cleaner, much more, I suppose, easier interface generally. And we're also now seeing that the SharePoint team site collection, the maximum size you can have for a team site, has been up from 1 terabyte to 25 terabytes. It doesn't mean you get 25 terabytes of free additional space, which is what I thought initially, bad me. But basically what it means is that the maximum size you can take a single site collection has been increased from 1 terabyte to 25 terabytes. But between you and me and anybody listening, I would foresee the day in the short term that we will see eventually 25 terabytes available to people. But they're the two major things that have happened around Office 365 and with SharePoint that people should know about. So what about in your area, Mark?
Well, somebody on Twitter, I think, replied to you in relation to that. Somebody, one of our reporters that we have on from time to time, I think Andre came back and said something about the 25 terabyte thing.
Yeah, basically alerted me to the fact that perhaps I hadn't read that specifically or correctly, and again highlighted that it was going to be just an increase in the size limit rather than an additional capacity. So I went back and double checked the figures and the Microsoft official page, and he was exactly 100% right. So I updated my information and thank him for pointing that out. A little bit of a letdown after seeing the initial tweet from Microsoft that it increased to 25 terabytes, but again, the increase was in the total size available that you can scale up to, not the amount of storage that you are going to be allocated. But I think it will come. But again, Andre did call that out and let me know, so I appreciate him for correcting me.
That's all right. Even the best of us gets mixed up from time to time. Even I go through the same thing. But speaking of Andre, Andre has got a news item in relation to CSP.
Well, Mark, there's two big changes from Microsoft coming out this year in terms of how they remunerate their resellers and partners.
So what does this entail?
Well, right now, the two major changes is how much they are remunerating their resellers, as well as how they are calculating that remuneration. Currently, a partner will receive a 12% rebate from Microsoft for selling Office 365, and they'll receive an additional 4% for managing that product as an ongoing rebate from Microsoft.
Yep.
And that is changing to a mere 3% only. So no longer do you get 12 plus 4, you only get 3% going forward.
And where do you get 3%? Well, at the sell time or at the ongoing time?
Going forward, that is your only rebate from Microsoft.
Wow.
You will no longer receive the 12% sell.
So basically, like, you sell it and you get no commission whatsoever. It's just basically ongoing stuff, which is 3%.
That's right. Given that Office 365 is a commodity product now and it's so widely adopted, Microsoft is no longer remunerating their partners for selling directly via credit card. Mm-hmm. What they are doing is allowing partners to purchase through the CSP program, where partners are able to set their own margins rather than relying on rebates from Microsoft.
All right. Thanks, Andre, for that. Rob, have you got any other Office 365 news, or should I jump into Azure news right now?
No, I think we better jump into Azure News, Mark. I know you're busting not only tell us the Azure News, but also to get to our very special guest that you managed to arrange for us. So let's start with the Azure stuff and make sure that we keep you as calm as possible.
Yeah, because you don't want to give me a heart attack. So the Rio Games that were on just recently. First, there was the Sochi. Is it Sochi Winter Games? Is that how you pronounce it? The Sochi,
yes,
or
that's
Sochi?
It, yes. Yep, it's in Russia. That's right.
Is that right? Sochi Winter Games back in 2014. Azure performed beautifully with no hitch whatsoever. So Azure did it again with the Rio 2016 Games and brought the games to millions of people across all devices and breaking the record for scale and reach for the largest sporting event on Earth. Good old Azure Media Services. So viewers streamed 2.71 billion minutes of Olympic coverage. It's a new record. The service handled 100 million unique users, 29% more than the 2012 London Olympics. 1080p profile for all stream channels, up from 720p for the Winter Olympics. Over 4,500 hours. Some phenomenal statistics here. Over 50 simultaneous Olympics events, 40% increase compared to the Winter Games, and 100 live channels continuously available for the Games. Amazing stuff. So good old Azure for putting that through. Fantastic. It's the good old scale that Azure's got. The other thing here is Redis Cache. Redis Cache has been around for a while. Rob, do you know what Redis Cache is? Are you familiar with it?
No, I can't say that I am, so fill us in.
Redis Cache is a distributed caching solution for Azure. Now, if you're building websites, traditionally you'll serve data from a persistent store like SQL, for example. But if you're serving data from SQL, it's slow because it's persistent, it's on disks and stuff. Whereas with Cache, you store data in memory, so it's much faster. And with Redis Cache, it's also very high throughput and very low latency, allowing you to serve data in under 10 milliseconds. And if you scale out a website, Redis Cache is the way to go because it's distributed. Now, the best practices for Redis Cache have just been released online, which cover everything, including memory, maximum size and scale, enhanced security, number of client connections, client cache in the same region, single-threaded rules, size and timeout, etc., etc., etc. The link we will put in the show notes, but definitely have a read of that if you're using Redis Cache, and it's definitely the recommended way to go if you're using any type of caching service in Azure. The other news that's come out is VMware Backup is now natively supported in DPM. DPM, Rob, stands for?
Data Protection Manager.
Well done. System Center Data Protection Manager 2012 R2 with update rollup 11 now supports VMware backups natively. No agents needed to be installed. DPM makes use of VMware's API to back up VMware's servers with no agent. So support for both ESXi, the free edition, or vCenter servers, whichever you want. Both Discover and Backup. We'll put the link in the show notes for more details on that. So that's pretty cool. Pretty good news as well. Also,
yep, lots of good stuff there happening.
There is. And we all love free stuff. The last thing I've got here too is Virtual Academy, the Microsoft Virtual Academy course, a new one that's come out, Introduction to Azure Security Center. The classic security model of protect, detect, respond still applies, but you must be adapted to modern environments and today's threats with protection extended to like SaaS and PaaS services. So detection technologies must become more sophisticated and leverage advanced analytics, behavioral analysis, and machine learning. You have to respond more quickly, shortening the time required to investigate, respond, and mitigate should there be a breach. So all the videos are online, just been released, and they're all totally free. So you got like videos which cover security roles, prevention deep dive, and detection deep dive. So again, the links will be in the show notes and will be on my blog site as well at markkeen.com. So that's that'll be online. And the courses are great because like Microsoft do put a lot of time and effort into putting these courses out, and they're covered by Microsoft folk themselves, the program managers of the security team, and also too, there's a lot of MVPs out there like yourself, Rob, who put a lot of courses out there too.
Yeah, luckily I've got a face for a podcast, so I've never actually done a Microsoft Virtual Academy. We'll stick to podcasting for the time being. But I think that our special guest that is coming on has actually done a couple of these, hasn't he?
Our special guest, yes, our very special guest. In fact, we were very, very lucky to get him on. In fact, extremely lucky.
Well, you did all the hard work. I just took all the glory.
Yeah, but it takes two to tango. You know that, right?
Fair enough. If I'm happy with that.
I couldn't have done it without you to start with. Anyway, we're waffling on about stuff here. We'll jump straight into it, eh?
Yeah, let's do that.
Hello, Mark.
Jeffrey Snover.
How you doing?
Good. We haven't got video here because our internet in Australia is not 100%. We're down
no problems.
The arse end of the world. But you're fine with your video if you want to keep it on. No, we've also got enough. Oh, cool. We've also got Robert Crane on the line. He's the other side of it who does the podcast with us. He's a MVP for Office 365. Rob, Jeff, Rob.
Hey, how are you going?
Doing well, thanks.
Thanks for coming on. I know it's obviously something to squeeze in between jobs, but no, really appreciate it.
Yeah,
definitely. 100%.
My pleasure.
So because of you, that's pretty much I live and breathe PowerShell at the moment.
Yay.
And I've got your Monad manifesto sitting beside me on the desk. I've printed that out. There's 16 pages of it, double-sided, in colour. So that's all there. And PowerShell is the best thing ever. And I'm not just saying that because you're on the call. Seriously, is it wakes me up in the middle of the night in my dreams, basically. Ideas come to me in the middle of the night about PowerShell, thinking, oh,
isn't
wow,
it great?
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
I just really love the fact that it allows you to express your creativity, and with the GUI, there's just no creativity.
And even if there was,
you couldn't show it. Like, oh, look at the clever way you combine those mouse clicks. Like, doesn't exist. But with the GUI, we're constantly running into somebody's office. Like, oh, check this out. Look what he did. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's good because it forces you to think. And the trick is, I find, is you've got to get into the zone. You can't just open PowerShell up and just use it. You've got to actually put the headphones on, lock yourself out, close the door to the room and really get into the zone. And once you get into the zone, you can sort of really push out some PowerShell until you have to, go to the toilet or get a coffee or whatever else. But
there you go.
Yeah. All right, we're just going to kick off. So, yeah, Jeffrey Snover, physics major, had a passion for physics, worked at Tivoli before Microsoft. You ran network management. So, just a bit of a history on what you did.
That's right. By the way, you say physics major. You say major when you drop out. Otherwise, you say physics degree.
So, you didn't actually finish? But that's the same with everybody at who were big in the tech industry. Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, and all that sort of stuff. They
Larry
go
Ellison.
Through to the end. They dropped out. Yeah, exactly. They sort of came out and they did something big. So you're part of the club.
Yeah, well, right now I'm Microsoft's highest ranked college dropout. So that's pretty good. Pretty good.
Fantastic. So when you began at Microsoft, we'll just give people a quick history, and I'm sure people have heard this before, but when you began at Microsoft, do you remember what year it was?
Yep, 99.
Okay, so that was at the time when Windows 95 was still current? 98? Windows 98, I would say?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
98, and I think ME was about to come out.
ME, yeah. I installed that on my machine back in the day, and It froze, it crashed, blue screened, and restarted. It had a good logo on it, ME, Millennium Edition. I think that's the reason why I installed it, because it looked really good, the colourful ME with the green. I thought, wow, that looks good. It looks environmentally friendly too, it's a tree. It should run really well, but no, it sort of crashed on me. I thought it was my computer. I thought, it can't be Microsoft, surely.
No, wait, where are you guys?
Sydney, in Australia.
Sydney. So, when Windows 95 came out, I was in Sydney when Windows 95 came out, and everybody was lined up at midnight to get the boxes.
Actually,
yep, that was me. I was at the store, lined up, looking at everybody else, waiting for that edition to hit my hand so I could run home.
Because remember,
at 1 o'clock in the morning, install.
it was first available in Sydney, right? Or I think it was New Zealand, and then next was in Sydney, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So it followed the clock around the world. New Zealand got it first, but no one was up early enough there. So when it hit Sydney, exactly, like I said, midnight, there was huge queues, and I've never seen that again. But it was a very interesting experience to be in. It's like, wow, we've crossed the Rubicon here if all these people are lining up for software. So, yeah, it had a huge impact on the industry.
Yeah, because I was actually in New Zealand at the time. I was actually 95. I was quite young. I was still like a young teenager. Living at home, and I remember when 95 came out, we bought a brand new family computer, and my mum said to me, "Here you go, here's a computer, here's Windows 95, install that." She gave me a job to do, and I've never really touched computers, and I said, "Okay, I'll install Windows 95 on the computer," and it was simple. I just put the disks in, and I go, "Next, next, 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 next." Bang, Windows. There you go, Mum. There's Windows 95. And she goes, "Great. That's fantastic. You should work in IT." So that's how I started.
Oh, that's great.
So so Windows 95 and then ME. And then, so do you want to just quickly talk about just PowerShell and how that began with Monad and I guess the name of it?
Yeah. So, you know, actually I got hired on to be the lead architect for all of management technologies and products. And I did some acquisitions and started some product efforts. But all the time I've been trying of advocating, boy, what we really need is an automation story, you know, command line shell, scripting engine, etc. And we start off with WMIC and then grew it from there. Basically, at some point I had this epiphany about how we should do command line interfaces. I did a deep rethink of the Unix model. Basically, I tried to take the Unix tools and bring them on Windows. And when I did that, they just basically didn't work. And the reason why I realized afterwards was this fundamental difference between the architecture of Unix and the architecture of Windows. The architecture of Unix is document or file based. Everything's in a file. So if you can edit a file and restart a process, you can manage the bulk of anything on Unix. So that's why awk, grep, and sed, text parsing tools and manipulation tools, those are management tools on a Unix box. But on Windows, when I took those very same tools, they didn't help at all. And the reason why is because Windows is an API-oriented operating system. We don't have our configuration in some .conf file. It's off behind some API, right? So grep didn't work against the registry, awk didn't work against WMI, sed didn't work against Active Directory. And so we needed to invent something new, and so that's what I did. I invented PowerShell.
So you're talking about the Unix part and the Linux part. It was I've got here that you went from A to B to C, like piping A, doing something in there, piping it through to B, massaging it even further and through to C. And then you also did something with WMIC, converting that into .NET.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, basically PowerShell started when I did this deep rethink of that Unix compositional model, which I refer to as A pipe to B pipe to C. You do something, then you pipe it to something else, and you do something, pipe it to the third thing. And basically what I said was, why do you do that? Why don't you just type A? And there's the traditional Unix model that says, oh, everything's a small little tool and you compose it all together through pipelines to solve novel problems. And that's an awesome story. It's the power of the Unix automation model. But I did some more thinking and I realized, well, there's another story. And the other answer is the heart of PowerShell. And the reason why A doesn't do what you want it to do is because it tightly couples three steps into one. A gets a set of objects. It processes those objects, and then it outputs those objects as text. And so then, when you pipe it to B and C, what you're really doing is, by the way, so when you say A didn't do what you wanted to do, what you're really saying is, well, I didn't get the right set of objects, or I didn't process them the right way, or I didn't output them as text the right way. Mm-hmm. And so piping it to B and C is really the process of taking that text and trying to reverse engineer your way back to the original objects to do one of those three steps differently. Mm-hmm. And I just said, no, why don't we just put the pipeline at that smaller level and pipeline the objects and only output the text when you want text? Because you know what? Parsing text, that's a pain in the butt. You know, it's what I call prayer-based parsing, right? And by the way, Unix guys have been doing this forever, and there are some people who are very good at it. I'm not one of those people, right? I can never get regular expressions, and I'm constantly like, okay, do I cut off three lines or four lines? Yeah. Do I go over 27 columns or 23 or 26, or is there a tab? Anyway, so objects dramatically simplified everything.
Yes, gotta love objects. Love them, custom objects. Yeah. So with that, you took that, and then it came out to the world first with Exchange 2007, with the management interface. And yep. And then I guess from there, I think that was quite cool, because I remember installing Exchange 2007 back in the day, and every time you did something in that management console, you say show code or show the PowerShell in the background. So it's actually a good way of learning PowerShell in those days, because you did something in the GUI and then click on the button show code and there's the code for it. So you've sort of know what it did with PowerShell, and you can sort of copy in that code in the background and sort of thing. So it was good in that respect.
Yeah, the Exchange guys were great partners, and they really got it.
So Jeff, what was the reaction internally to Microsoft when you came up? So look, you know, I've got a new tool here, this PowerShell, or it's early concepts, and you know, we're going to do scripting line and Unix style environment. You know, obviously the company at that stage was very much in the GUI and was doing that sort of thing. Was it something that, you know, people jumped on board, or was it something that was proved to be a bit of a hard sell? What was sort of the adoption inside Microsoft, or the reaction when you first started, you know, spruiking this tool?
Yeah, do you have any children listening?
Not yet, not at the moment. We can beat stuff out.
Let's see. So one of the reactions was, exactly what part of Windows is confusing you, Jeffrey? And yeah, there was not a lot of reception towards it. There was not a friendly reception. It was a lot of work. And so, you know, I just kept at it, explaining. And at some point, I remember my executive finally got it. Like, she got it. Oh, you know, this is why you need command line interfaces. And I was so pleased. Yay. Now everything will be solved. And then she asked this question. She said, well, which 10? And I said, well, which 10 what? And she said, well, which 10 should we do? I said, I'm sorry, I'm confused. Which 10 what are you saying? She says, well, which 10 commands should we do? And I said, well, we need commands for everything. And she says, yeah, but that's a lot of work. So why don't we start with 10 and see how far we get? And I thought to myself, oh, my Lord, this is going to be so difficult. So, and, you know, it made sense at the time, right? It was at a time when Microsoft had taken, you know, a PC and put this awesome kernel and put a GUI on top of it, and they were winning the world, right? This is server for the masses. Now anybody could buy, deploy, and operate your own server, whereas before you could never do that. And, you know, we were just kicking people who only had command line interfaces, like, we're kicking their butt. We're selling hundreds of times more than them. Why would we want to emulate them? And the answer is, well, as long as it was about one machine, yep, a GUI's perfect. I love it. But that's not where we're going. We're going to be successful. And when we're successful, there are going to be tens, hundreds, thousands, millions of these things. And you're not going to walk up to each one of those things and manage it with the GUI. So if anything, I think that I would say that, how's this for positioning? I had more confidence in the success of Windows Server than they did. And therefore, I could see that it was going to need something different. And they were just looking at their current success and thinking, I'm rocking it already.
So what was the tipping point? Was there a tipping point in your mind that said, you know, PowerShell's made it, or it's crossed the, you know, the Rubicon, with, you know, enough people are adopting it, I'm hearing people talking about it, I'm getting conference gigs to talk about PowerShell? Was there a singular moment, or it just basically organically grew once it started to be adopted more widely?
Well, basically, you know, I got to say it took many, many years of hard struggle, like really hard struggle. There were years that were, you know, some people here that just made my life pure misery. And that went on for years. But as soon as we got it shipped in Windows, then I knew, you know, that was it. You know, we still had more work to do. We had a lot of work to do. But once it was shipping in Windows, I knew that then that was going to, you know, have a physics of its own. Because, you know, once you're in, you know, once you're in Windows, right, you're on a path to be installed on over a billion machines. And that carries a certain weight to it. It has its own momentum. And as long as you don't screw that up by, you know, you got to continue to invest. You have to be good. right? If you have bad stuff on a billion machines, that's no good. So you have to have a good idea, and we did. And then you have to keep investing. You have to listen to customers and respond to those guys. But if you did that, you were going to make it. So no, it was the day before we were in Windows, it could have all gone pear-shaped. In fact, getting into Windows, there was this dramatic moment where we had done everything that we were told you have to do to get this into Windows. We pushed the request saying, hey, we'd like to change and now make this part of Windows. And shortly afterwards, one of the big executives wrote back this letter saying, you withdraw this request. And I'm sitting with another guy in the office, and we're looking at this email, looking at each other like, oh my gosh, what the heck are we going to do with this? And he says, watch this. And he wrote back and he says, no, you turn it down. And the guy did turn it down, and then that caused a big fight, and ultimately it worked. It prevailed. But again, there were some good reasons why they were being buttheads, but they were being buttheads.
So speaking of getting things into Windows, back before PowerShell came into Windows, it was, I guess, going back in time, it was all about .NET, right? So I guess, similar to getting PowerShell into Windows, they tried it a different way. They put .NET into Windows, didn't they, with Longhorn and Vista. So if you want to just quickly explain the reason why putting .NET into Windows was a bad idea into the kernel.
Yeah, okay, so I mentioned to you that they were kind of buttheads, but there was a good reason for it. And the reason for it was that we, you know, Vista, right, a lot of people know about Vista, and they also will say, hey, that wasn't our finest moment. And the answer is, well, compared to the thing that went before it, which was Longhorn, it was awesome because it actually shipped. Longhorn was the thing where we said, hey, we're going all in on .NET. And there's a good reason for that. However, instead of being smart guys and saying, okay, what does that mean? How should I use it? People just went and did stupid things with .NET. And they were sort of mindless things. So for instance, you know, indeed some people were putting .NET in the kernel, like not the right technology in the kernel, not the right technology. Next, they were integrating it into common control. So you know how when you go to any command, any GUI, and you say save, you get the same dialog box, right?
Yep.
That's called the common controls. And so what they did was they said, okay, well, we'll take that common controls and we'll make it .NET based. So we'll re-implement it in .NET. Now, here's what that means. So you run Notepad, right? And Notepad comes up in a heartbeat. And yep. What? It's like a couple K, 10K. You know, tens of K memory size. And then, you know, fast as wind, very small. And then you say save, and all or save as, and all of a sudden you go from like 10K to like 18 megabytes because you just paged in .NET. And it was slow as all heck. And there's all sorts of problems like that. And what had happened was, you know, we did not have good engineering systems. We did not have good engineering management, you know, or let us say, you know, checkpointing. And we just kept going and going and going, building up this mess. And at that point, we had to stop and say, hey, wait, this is never going to work. And so that's when we had what was called the Longhorn reset. And that was so painful. It was so painful. They basically sort of threw out the baby with the bathwater. And at least in the minds of the Windows guys at that time, it was not, oh, I'm a bad engineer because I took this technology and did something stupid with it. It's that's a bad technology. You know, it's a very natural human reaction, right? Anyway, yeah. That's how they, you know, it was a very difficult time, and that's why they got burned. Now, it turns out, let's be clear, .NET's awesome. .NET's awesome. But like any tool, it's a tool, and you've got to use the tool for the things it's used for, or it's useful for, right? Don't use a hammer like a screwdriver. Don't like a screwdriver like a hammer. It's fantastic. I mean, I just love .NET, and it's fantastic for what I'm using it for. Probably not the best technology for writing a kernel.
But I guess back in those days, like, the engineers were, like, listening to management. And I guess the memo said .NET, 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 and Windows. And I guess they wanted to keep their jobs. They were getting paid. They had mortgages to pay, possibly, and they had family. So they wanted just to basically do what management want, even though it wasn't exactly the right thing to do. But I guess the difference is you knew exactly that it was a bad thing to do, and you sort of more put that out there. And I guess it's a good thing, because now, if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here today where we are. And now that you're, what are you now, technical fellow and lead architect for the Enterprise Cloud Group?
Yeah, that's right. And so
Windows Server
fellow and the lead architect. That's Windows Server, Azure Stack, System Center, and Operations Management Suite.
So the reason why we've got you on, I know we've taken a bit of a bum steer to begin with, a bit of a history sort of a lesson in Microsoft and PowerShell and stuff like that. But the reason why I've got you on is to talk about OMS with a focus on desired state configuration. So OMS, just to set the scene, is big at the moment for metrics for the Microsoft folk. And I guess there's a lot of people that want to see people installing OMS out there and using it, especially with the consumption part of it, but also to the desired state configuration part of it, which came out a couple of years ago or a few years ago, then that's all part of OMS too. So if you want to just quickly explain to the folk in brief what OMS is, that'll be fantastic.
Yeah, so first let me start off with one of the problems, right? So I've been doing management for the bulk of my 30-plus years in the industry, and it just turns out that, you know, managing products are absolutely critical. People who get that right see, you know, just compelling results, are able to drive their business forward in ways that people who don't get it right seem to struggle. But, you know, it's a subset of people that can be successful with these products. And why is it? And the answer is the products themselves tend to be extremely complicated, right? So one of the jokes when I worked at Tivoli was, you know, people think they're buying an aircraft carrier. And the answer is, no, they're buying to the parts with an aircraft carrier, and they got to figure out how to stitch it all together and make it work. And so Operations Management Suite now is focused in on that problem. What it says is, we're going to make it easy for people to use the management products instead of having to have them, you know, allocate some really, you know, their smartest people or spend a ton of money on systems integration to plan the product deployment, to deploy it, to keep it up and running. And if you ever attended MMS, our Microsoft Management Summit, but, you know, the early days of that, it seemed like about a third of the sessions were all about how to get SMS or SCCM up and running, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Approach it carefully, don't make any sudden movements, you know, stuff like that.
The database, SQL and, Server.
Exactly. Kill a chicken before you migrate the schema. All sorts of terrible things. Well, now we run those products in Azure, and then they can manage your stuff. They can manage your stuff in Azure. They can manage your stuff in, if you have it in AWS or Google Cloud, or you can manage your stuff in on-premises systems using gateways. So that's the idea, is you can now use these products, managing products, running in the cloud to then manage anything. And we start off small. We're focused in on a few key scenarios. So, of course, we've got I forget what the current name is, but basically log analytics. We take all your logs and then do big data on it. I don't know if you try that. Like, people like that story, like, oh, I'll grab all my logs and then I'll do these big data analysis on it. It's like, yeah, it's an awesome story. Have you ever tried to set up a big data system? Well, let me tell you something, my friend. It's a challenge. It is a challenge. Well, we do that for you. We just collect your logs and then we do the big data analytics in the cloud, and you're able to slice and dice all your logs. It's just amazing. So then we also have a data protection manager, so you do backups to the cloud, and we have Azure Site Recovery, and then we've got Azure Automation and Configuration Management. So Azure Automation, you know, PowerShell is this great management infrastructure. And desired state configuration is the next level of that, where instead of writing sort of this imperative program, do this step and do this step and then do this step, desired state configuration allows you to say, here's the way the world ought to be. Make it so. And then underneath the covers, we have this Make It So engine that looks at the way the world ought to be, looks at the way the world is, and then performs actions to bring it in sync. And then it will monitor for deviations and auto-correct them. So it's a wonderful system. But both these technologies are really sort of platform or, you know, framework technologies, which is to say that often people look at it and say, hey, I can script my own solution, but really I want a product on top of that, something that's going to give me, you know, a logging and editing and the tools necessary for a team of people to do this together as a team. And a number of products do that. System Center does that. Chef and Puppet, if you're familiar with those tools, they're DevOps yep. tools. But OMS, so OMS does this. So Azure Automation is running PowerShell in the cloud with schedules and logging and yep. auditing and credential management, super important. And then now they've got desired state configuration or configuration management, which leverages the desired state configuration engine. Mm-hmm. But then it again does, you know, has a pull server in the cloud, does reporting and change management analysis. So it's an area where we've started off small, but then we're investing pretty heavily in that.
So all these products, so OMS is like the engine. I guess the confusing part is, like, site recovery in itself is a product, and you can jump onto the portal, you can go configure site recovery. There's like 5 steps to set up. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's quite easy to set up. You can go in there into the site recovery area. You can see the monitors. You can click on all the different replication partners you've got, and you can see whatever percentage the replication's up to and so forth. The same with backup, the same with like Azure Automation. So the OMS part on top of it all, how does that come into play when you've already got the separate components underneath?
Basically, it's sort of like the System Center suite issue, right? So we sell System Center, we have a set of products, and then you can sell it as a suite. Now, the reality is with System Center, we always tried to integrate those things, but the integration was more at the like brochure and financial level.
Licensing?
Excuse me. Yeah, exactly. And the true okay. integration of the products, you know, so we did some very good work there, but it was not something that we did from the get-go. Mm-hmm. With OMS, that's something we're doing from the get-go. And it just turns out that putting things all in the cloud, we're able to move very quickly, modify things, and we're leveraging a microservices architecture. I guess I'd say services architecture. They're big enough to not call them microservices. But we just, you know, we now have this agile development model, and so on a pretty regular cadence, we get everybody together and show them, show our current work, the stuff that's probably going to be, we'll probably show you at Ignite. Anyway, so we just did one of those a week ago, and I was blown away. It's like, wait, what did you just do? And the answer is, well, we're calling this service to get this information, we're calling this service to get this information, we're calling this service to get this integration information, and we're putting it all together in this glorious experience. So it really is a very nicely integrated suite of capabilities. And I'll just say, you know, we're going to show you some cool stuff at Ignite, and I guarantee it's just going to get better from there. There's a lot to be done here. There's just a lot of great things that can happen.
Okay, Jeff. So, I mean, obviously a fantastic product and allows us to manage a lot of stuff now, but who do you see OMS particularly for? Do you see it as a large enterprise, a hoster? Do you see it potentially scaling down to an SMB, or is it going to cover the whole range, do you think? Is it a suite for everybody, or is it at a particular niche?
Yeah, so let's just put, I'd say that the cloud is changing everything, and so I think everybody's going to have a different journey to the cloud and a different endpoint with the cloud. So for people who are using managing products, I think the vast majority of them will use this approach over the course of time. I think a bunch of people are not going to be using managing products in the future. I think a bunch of people are going to say, hey, why was I running Exchange anyway? Why don't I just use Exchange in the cloud or SharePoint? Now, some people will say, no, I get a distinct business advantage running it. And those people, I think, will use these products. But I think a lot more people will see. I believe this the cloud is this fundamental shift, and that anybody tells you, here's what's going to happen, they're nonsense, right? They're either deluded or they're wrong, right? I think it's an emergent thing. There's going to be zigs and zags. Some things are going to be popular, and then they're going to collapse, et cetera. So I don't think anybody really knows how it's going to play out, and I think it's going to take another decade or so before it settles down. But the one thing I'm absolutely convinced is this one business phenomenon, because at the end of the day, there's technology and there's business, right? Technology comes and goes, but business concerns. That's what drives everything. And the business concern is this, and that is, how do I leverage technology to drive my business forward, right? And so I just ask the simple question, hey, if you're running your own exchange or you're running your own SharePoint, that's great. Does that help you advance your business goals, right? Does run an exchange better than your competitors allow you to sell more airplane tickets or more cars or more this or that? And for most people, the answer is no. There just was no other opportunity. And for those people, I think that they're no longer to use management tools. They're going to get that as a service and just consume it. A bunch of people will say, no, I actually do drive benefit, competitive advantage from either these products, or more importantly, I'm layering a line of business application to go drive my business, right? What we're seeing is more and more companies are becoming software companies. You thought they were something else, but they're actually a software company. Uber, guess what? Uber's not about cars. Uber's about software, right? Alaska Airlines, the CIO of Alaska Airlines basically said, yeah, we're a software company with wings, okay? And the point there is, hey, when I'm competing on wings, there's only so much competition. But when I compete with a whole customer experience, with the IT that I can do, and I can deliver a better experience there, I can hugely differentiate my company from the other people. It's just this blank slate that I can provide a lot more value than I can with just an aluminum tube with wings on it. And so everybody's going to be doing that. So, the people who can best figure out how to harness computing to drive their business forward, those are the folks that we are seeing get just huge business advantages. Those are the guys who are going to win. And again, whether they're using Docker or containers or this or that, blah, 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 over the time that'll all change. But the one thing I know is that a lot of people will be leveraging the cloud because the cloud allows them to focus in at higher levels versus the lower levels. So, make any sense?
Yes, no, it seriously did. It did. And I fully agree. Like, I'm cloud, cloud, cloud. In fact, I should change my middle name to cloud or even Microsoft, because I'm onto it. I'm fully. But the question I've got is the roadmap for OMS, and OMS is like a replacement. It's like SCOM on-prem, but it's running in the cloud. Yep. It's like a monitoring product, and it's got agents and stuff like that. Now,
SCOM and then SCA, System Center Automator.
Yeah, all of that sort of stuff. So the roadmap for OMS, is that to eventually replace SCOM? Like, I guess SCOM is going to have an end of life at some stage with OMS taking over, right? Or
I don't think so. I got some buddies at IBM. Guess what? They're still selling mainframes. These things, and so I have a talk out there where I talk about the various eras of server, right? We had the server for the masses, the enterprise server, the data center server, and now we're merging the cloud server. And the point is that these eras never really go away. They just get more, bigger or smaller. And in fact, they rarely get that much smaller. It's just the new era gets a whole lot larger. So no, I expect System Center is going to be around for quite a long time. Certainly we're investing that way, so I hope it is. But that said, I don't think, how much is it going to change? I think you'll see most companies now invest their smartest people and their newest innovation trying to figure out the cloud. I don't see a whole bunch of them doing, and making large capital investments in old school models.
Jeff, my background is mainly around the SMB space. So question sort of coming out of that angle is if I'm a small managed service provider and I'm looking at the fantastic technologies that are part of OMS, is this something that I can deploy across my whole client? So can I multi-tenant it so I can go in and look at a whole range of clients on a nice dashboard? Is that possible with OMS?
I do not believe that that is currently available. That is something we strive to provide, though. Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, if I'm a smaller end of town, do I need to wait, or is there, how can I get into OMS, and is it just something that I can start playing with, or do you think that there's a way that I can start applying it to, you know, my customers and my business?
Well, here's, again, one of the great things about it, right? So if at some point somebody said, hey, you know, is System Center the right thing for me? The answer would be, well, why don't you hold off and figure that out before you make your first step? Because the first step in the past was installing System Center, which wasn't a lightweight thing. With OMS, it's incredibly lightweight. In fact, it's free to start using OMS. So you just go up to OMS and you say, hey, I'd like to start using this. And there's a certain level of functionality that's available for free. And so you install this, start pumping your events up there, start doing your event management. You'll see we collect these events and then do analytics. Hey, do you have an intruder in your system? What things have been changing in your environment? There's a certain level of automation that you can get for free. And you can kick the tires and find out for yourself.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Sorry, I was just going to say that's really good, and I think that's a real incentive and one of the changes that we've seen, in the way the products are delivered, especially from Microsoft, this ability to trial them and do all that sort of stuff, and that really speaks to the SMB market. It lets people get in there and get a feel for the product. So I think that's great. Yeah, sorry, Mark, continue.
You have to be a DBA. If you want to install System Center, you have to be a DBA as well. But then these days, DBAs are separate to people that install System Center, because I used to be an IT pro, and I've installed SCOM back in the day and SCCM back in the day. And the SQL part, I got to that question. I thought, where's your SQL server? And I thought, uh-oh, how do I install SQL? It's like, that's not exactly next. You've got to actually plan to install SQL. You've got to have the logs on a certain drive, the database on a certain drive, and not only that, has to be highly available, and then you're going to have to cluster it somehow and have to different services. So that's a nightmare.
Did you ever put a database on a partition that was too small? Like, oh, that's a bad day.
Well, I'm sure people did. But I was lucky because there's always somebody at the places where I was working that was seemed to like SQL. But I don't know. To this point, I'm lucky that Azure SQL in the cloud, and also to the platform. But you're right. The fact that you can just go onto Azure, fire it up, and start it. And this is what I did for my startup business. I basically did the same thing. I used a free tier of OMS, and I jumped in there and I installed the agents on the distributed the PCs out in the field. And I made use of the new custom logs and the custom fields. So this part I think is pretty powerful, uh-huh, because as soon as I put the agent on the machines, I could then go through in OMS and say, okay, feed OMS an example of a log, and it could be any log file, .log.xls, could be a CSV file, could be anything, and go through and I'll ingest that as a custom log, and then you can go through the next part and do custom fields. I know it's still in preview at the moment, but I think this part is probably one of the most powerful parts of the log analytics part. Is I can put my custom logs in here and generate the fields. So my question is, and I'm not sure if you know the answer to it, but the custom fields works on some sort of pattern algorithm?
Yeah, I believe that we have a number of techniques for that, right? So we'll auto-generate regular expressions. Oh, actually, you know what? Now I do know the answer to this. So we worked with MSR. So are you familiar with the... which version of PowerShell are you using? Version 5?
Version 5, yes.
Okay. So have you seen the new convert from string? Is it convert from string or convert from... Yeah, convert from string?
Yes.
Okay, so that is using artificial intelligence. What we do is it's parsed by example. You give it a few examples of data, and then it auto-generates the parser for the subsequent things. That was some crazy artificial intelligence technology that Microsoft Research came up with, and it is integrated both into PowerShell version 5 and into the log analytics. That's how we're doing it.
Is this similar to like, I could be wrong here, but is this similar to like fuzzy lookup in Excel where it learns?
Yes, that's exactly correct. I remember, was it called Fuzzy Lookup? But yes, it's the originally this got surfaced and publicized as part of an Excel feature. And then we had to work with them to get a different implementation.
Same
so
group.
Work for us. But
research
yeah,
group did it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Fuzzy Lookup, got to be the best ever add-in for Excel. I'll have to check out that feature. I didn't realize because I've been looking for a Fuzzy Lookup part of in PowerShell for a long time. It's like a,
oh, yeah, that's it.
Awesome.
That's all exactly right. The technology.
I think, like I said, one of the big changes that we've seen with PowerShell is the fact that it is now being open sourced, obviously, in some respect. And again, we're going to see the release of Windows Server 2016 very shortly, which is obviously, you know, going to make some other major updates and major opportunities for people. Jeff, what do you see as sort of the roadmap going forward for, you know, the PowerShell and the integration throughout the Microsoft products? Is there anything that you can give us a bit of insight into as the direction that the product's going to take? Are we going to see a version 6 out shortly? I mean, you know, where do you see it? Where do you think it's going?
Good question.
Yeah, okay. So this is probably the largest change ever in PowerShell we just announced. And so indeed, when we see version 6, version 6 is available today. But what does that actually mean? And the answer is now we're doing all of our development out in the community. We're doing all the source code is available on GitHub. That is where we do our development. We don't publish to GitHub. We do our work in GitHub. And we are doing the next version is version 6. At some point, we'll snap that and put it into Windows and make it available. It's available, version 6 available on both Windows and on Linux. And as I say, it's open source. So we are actively allowing our community, our users, to take a look at the source code. They can add features. They can fix bugs and do pull requests. And we'll accept those pull requests and if they meet the right bars. And they'll be shipping their source code as part of Windows. It's pretty crazy stuff. And one of our projects, as the community gets up to speed and becomes expertise on the source code, they will have an opportunity to be a committer. So that means that when someone in the community submits a change, someone else in the community will have the authority to accept that change into PowerShell. So in other words, it's no longer the PowerShell team as being, think of it this way, the PowerShell team is no longer entirely employed by Microsoft.
Yeah. There are like, it's a worldwide, it's the biggest software team in the world.
It's pretty exciting, yeah. And so, you know, we are getting some great feedback from the community. We are getting code from the users. And again, a lot of this has to do with, you know, going to Linux is because of Satya, right? Satya's great leadership. Basically, he told us, get out of your offices, go talk to customers, figure out what it takes to make them successful, and then do that. He says, don't worry about the money. Look, I got smart guys. If you're making customers successful, we have smart people that can figure out how to turn that into money. If our customers are not successful using our products, it's really hard to monetize that. So go find out what it takes to be successful. When we talk to people, you know, people want to be able to use any client to manage any server running on any cloud. And that means, and by the way, when you want to do that, it's a pain in the butt. It's really, really hard. And a bunch of people said, boy, you know, if PowerShell is available on Linux, you know, if then anybody, whether they could pick any client they want and manage Windows. And we said, well, would you also want to manage Linux? And they said, well, you could do that? I said, yeah. And so anyway, that's why we're doing it.
So speaking of smart people, and another smart person that we all know of is Mark Rasinovich. I guess the question is, what is he really like as a person?
Oh, he's great. Yeah, no, he's a great guy.
Is he? Because we've seen a lot of videos. We've seen a lot of there's heaps of them online. You guys do presentations together. Him doing presentations, you're doing presentations. Basically, I think
you guys are pretty much on the same level as such. How much of your work and how much of Mark Rusinovich's work would sort of cross paths? Or
it's one of the, so first let's be clear, Mark is just fantastic technical contributor, right? And I welcome his contributions, anytime I can get them. So, again, I was lead server of Windows Server, but the reality is that for the container stuff, Mark really was the technical sponsor for that work. So he was hands-on with that team working to those guys, and I kind of monitored that stuff, but he drove that. So that, that was my great benefit. And now I'm doing Azure Stack. And so in Azure Stack, I get to work closely with Mark, right? He's doing Azure, yep. And then I'm taking a portion of that and getting it to run on customers, in customers' data centers. And as we do that, there's a number of issues that come up, and we get to collaborate on those. And I got to say that, you've seen these pictures of Microsoft org charts with guns pointed at each other. And in the past, that certainly has been the case of things. And one of the things I feel, quite proud about is that has not really existed between Windows Server and Azure. And I think a big part of that is the friendship that Mark and I have, right? Mm-hmm. Indeed, there's always conflicts that come up. But when those conflicts come up and you hear that, those jerks over, and it was, what are you talking about? No, that doesn't sound right. Hold on, let me just call Mark and find out what's going on. And then things get resolved. And the same thing, vice versa. Say, hey, Jeffrey, what's going on here? So I don't know, let's go work it out. So the fact that we've been, friends.
Good relationship.
I think, great rapport has really helped the teams work together, and therefore the product that we're able to deliver to customers. I'm really quite proud of that. And people who watch us will know we love to give each other lots of grief, and that's just
we thought we'd give you an opportunity here, Jeff, to stick one in while we've got an opportunity, since Mark's not with us at the moment. So please feel free to avail yourself of any opportunity.
I will. Here's a little known fact. Rusinovich, this guy, he's like a puppy. He follows me around the world. It's true. So I'm living in Nashua. He moves to Nashua. Nashua, New Hampshire. You ever heard anybody come from Nashua, New Hampshire? Well, apparently he must have heard I was living there, because he goes and lives in Nashua. So then I leave there and I go to move to Austin, Texas. Guess where Rusinovich goes?
Austin, Texas.
He goes from that to Austin, Texas. Exactly. Following me there. And then I moved to Microsoft up here. And guess what he does next? Guy's unbelievable.
Must be a latency issue, Jeff, I'd say. Has to do with latency, I'm sure. I've got one last question.
He just wants to bask in the glory, I think.
Oh, I see. That's great. Well, works for us.
See, here, maybe some of it will rub off.
Hang around with smart people, you become smart people.
So what we'll do is we'll give Mark Rusinovich the opportunity to come on our podcast and rescind that. So anyway, but we can have you back on again, Jeff, to continue the conversation or the argument. But
it's like a tennis game.
Let me finish off with just one more question from me before we throw back to Mark again. If, unsurprisingly, anyway, to me, maybe not to you, Jeff, but there are still a lot of people out there who are yet to get across PowerShell, who are yet to look at stuff like the OMS, who are yet to do Azure. In your book, what's a really good step? For those out there who have sort of seen it on the sidelines, know that they should get into it, perhaps been a bit daunted by seeing how popular and how big it's become, what's the best place for them to start? Where would you tell them, look, start here to start improving your knowledge around all this stuff, especially PowerShell? What's a really good starting point in your books to get up to speed with this technology?
Yeah, so there's two answers I give. So first is there's a Microsoft Virtual Academy that I did with Jason Helmlich, and it's PowerShell version 3, Getting Started in Advanced. That will give you a great foundation. And the number of people that have come up to me and thanked me for that thing, it's all free, is just enormous. So people have been very successful with that. The other is that our GitHub repository, our PowerShell repository, has a Getting Started page. And basically, that's a community contributed to document that has the conventional best wisdom for how to get started with PowerShell. And so there's recommendations for books and courses and training. So those are the two answers.
Okay, cool.
Excellent.
And we're coming to the end of it, so I'm going to ask one of the final questions here, and probably a big question to save all the confusion out there in the whole world. What is the proper pronunciation of Azure or Azure?
I have no idea. I call it Azure.
Azure, yeah, because I guess it was a rhetorical question because I heard,
you know what? When Rusinovich comes on, you can ask him.
In fact, I saw a video of him was asked the same question, and his answer was, when you go down to the shop and buy some groceries, and as you come back, say Azure is basically it.
What?
So yeah. that was the way he described it. Exactly that. When you get out of the shop and come back.
I now reserve the right to revise and amend my comments. Mark is often a very smart guy. I don't know what the heck that answer was. As you're coming back.
That's exactly what he said. I'll bring it up with him and just to make sure that I'm not hearing things. I should have actually got a link or kept a link to that that video. It was quite a good answer when I heard it. I thought, you know what, that's quite a good way of describing it.
Here, I'll give you something you can surprise him with. Ask him about CP3O's head.
Okay. All right, we will.
You know Star Wars?
Yeah, we know.
Oh, so you know the thing?
Yeah.
Mark has his head.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. I'm visiting him at his house, and I'm looking around, I'm like, what the heck is that? I said, oh, it's CP3O's head. Like, the real thing? He says, yeah. So, life is good.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you for coming on, and I seriously appreciate your time. You're like a massively busy person, especially with Ignite coming up very shortly, and everything else coming out, and all the great stuff that's happening at Microsoft. So, seriously, thank you for your time today. And if people want to get hold of you, or I guess follow you on Twitter, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, Twitter at jsnover, JSNOV as in victory, ER.
Cool, and we'll put a link to this on our Twitter. Would very much appreciate it if you can retweet that out for us as well.
Absolutely.
All right, Jeff. I think I'll thank you on behalf of all the listeners, and again, all the information you've shared. As Mark indicated, very busy person, and we appreciate your time. Again, thank Mark for setting all this up and making all this happen in the background. Is there anything else we need to do before we finish off and let Jeff get back to writing more PowerShell code so that we know how many seconds before he gets his new device?
there'll be a next time, so we'll have to let him go for now.
Okay, sounds great.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.